Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Summer Helene, the Duchess of Hollywood, Executive Vice President of California Pictures at Paramount. Summer Helene is not only one of the youngest executives in Hollywood history, she will soon be announcing her place as one of the few women and the youngest studio head in Hollywood history. Summer Helene's tenacity, demeanor, and her uncompromising style earned her the nickname Duchess of Hollywood. The Duchess is known for her ability to get any film made, and is often asked to share her experiences in Hollywood on television and radio shows, as well as on panels at Comic-Con and most major film festivals. On Friday nights, Summer Helene shares her experiences as the host of the wildly successful radio show Behind the Scenes. Behind the Scenes helps both aspiring and experienced entertainers easily navigate the Hollywood machine. Throughout her 15-year career, Summer Helene has won multiple awards and worked with Mountain Pictures, Moon River Cinema, Discovery, and Paramount Pictures, as well as working with award-winning directors Owen Land, George Landau, Michael Burton, Emmy Award-winning writer Dev Ross, and composer Vasily Shumov. While working with Dev Ross, Land Before Time, and The Darkwing Duck, Summer Helene spearheaded a new television format with The Rocks, a groundbreaking television series supported by the city of Sedona. Using this new format, Summer Helene has helped celebrities and filmmakers bring their dreams to both the big and small screen. A noted feminist and philanthropist, Summer often uses her Hollywood friends and connections to support animal and children's charities. And so with that, I'd like to welcome Summer to the show. Good day, Summer.
G'day, g'day. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. There's a little bit of that Australian coming out there.
There's a fair amount of Australian there on board. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yes, as a matter of fact, I think behind the U.S. and Canada, Australia is one of my most listened to the countries that most that most listen to my show. I've had quite a few folks from down under. Yes.
Well, hi to everyone back home. My brother's out there right now, so.
Good. I just spoke to a friend from Sydney yesterday. So this is I love it. I have yet to visit, but I understand it's a beautiful, beautiful spot in the planet.
It's stunning. It's absolutely stunning.
Well, I am looking forward to our chat today. I mean, there is so much of Hollywood that I don't know about, so I'm looking forward to enlightening me and the listeners. So, I would first love to start with, I mean, how is it that you got involved with the film industry? Kind of give us a thumbnail as to your journey that led you to be involved in the industry.
Actually, I wanted to be a nun for a little while, and my dad, I really did, and my dad said, I just want to be a nun because I want to be a good person, and I can be a good person without being a nun. And then I was offered a job modeling for Victoria's Secret, and my dad talked me into taking that, which is a little odd in itself, but I got into it through that, and I'd always wanted to be an actress. And I started acting for a while and realized I hated it. Absolutely hated it. Didn't like the attention. Didn't like any of it. And it was the porn star, Ron Jeremy, of all people, that talked me into getting behind the camera.
Hmm. Wow.
So it's a little bizarre.
It is. That is definitely a journey with a lot of twists and unexpected, kind of turns. So, so that's kind of how you got then behind the camera. So now, how did you get the title Duchess of Hollywood? How did that come about?
Quite sarcastically, actually. There was an article about me, and they were talking about Hollywood royalty, and the comment was, Beyonce may be the queen, but Summer's a duchess. She's still royalty and can make anybody famous. So I ended up with the nickname The Duchess because of that article. I also ended up with the nickname The Wicked Witch of the West Coast. So I like the Duchess one better than The Wicked Witch of the West Coast. But my hashtag is Hollywood Bad Guys. So I think I'm going to have to learn to embrace it, since that's what I usually get.
Okay. So now, to me that's, that's fascinating. I mean, so what is it that you think that led to that, the Wicked Witch, or that bad aspect? What was it? Is it, what is it in your work that kind of, brought that about?
I'm very, very good at what I do. I'm also very difficult to work with. But I've never had a flop. All my films come in ahead of time and under budget. And any company I work for, we manage to bring up the revenue. But to do that, I am very, very cutthroat. So I'm very good at what I do, but I don't expect anything less than perfection for myself or anyone else. So it makes me damn near impossible to work with.
Okay, well, that's a double-edged sword there. So, so obviously with, that kind of cutthroat aspect, I mean, is that, I often think, when I think of Hollywood, and the machine, the Hollywood machine, I often hear of, that aspect, that cutthroat, the down and dirty, this is the way it is kind of atmosphere. I mean, is that pretty much the way that it is?
It is very much the way it is.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's not always, most people aren't like that. Most people in Hollywood love to be loved and love to get on. And most of the A-list actors were so easy and fantastic to work with that they kept working.
Yeah. So now, being that you're, when you say that you're difficult to work with, it's just the fact that you have clear-cut expectations and that you expect people to meet those, and if they don't, what are the consequences?
Well, they're not working with me anymore or ever again.
Yeah.
It's Hollywood's a funny place. You're dealing with millions and millions of dollars of other people's money. So people make fun of the fact that Tim Burton and Johnny Depp work together a lot, or you see the same directors and actors work together when I finance a film or when I get involved in distribution with a show. I work with people I know because it's a large financial risk. There are people that have put their money on the line for these projects, and I want to make sure they get their return. And to do that, I use people I know and trust. That's the reason Hollywood seems so closed off and the same people work together again and again, is because you know that that person's going to come through for you, and you know that nobody's going to get screwed.
Yeah.
So it's really important to build those relationships.
Yeah, I've noticed that, and quite often when you hear, actors or when you hear the people, the participants within the industry, you often hear the emphasis on relationships, and it really, it seems that, so now if someone is not within that circle, of relationships, is it possible to break in, or is it kind of just a someone a friend of a friend kind of thing?
It's usually a friend of a friend. It's not impossible to break in, and it's not even that hard to break in. All you need is someone to believe in you. work with the same companies even. I work with certain companies. I work, like, right now I'm actually in Palm Springs at an ATV place called Off-Road Rentals. And they do ATV rides. And we work with them in a lot of films. We use their land to film. They do product placement in our shows. We work with them. And I've hired people that were here that have worked for this company. So people have gotten into the industry because they worked for a product partner. Or I've met people that I like or get on with. My assistant, who's now a producer herself, I hired because she walked into a job she was woefully unqualified for at 18 and said, you're going to hire me. Let me tell you why. A lot of people go with their gut. They really do. And if you impress them, they'll take a risk on you because someone took a risk on them. When I got the job, I was assisting, when I started assisting a producer when I was 17, I was woefully underqualified. But he took a risk on me because I walked in and said, you're going to hire me.
Wow. It seems like that self-confidence is real important when it comes to promoting yourself within the industry.
Yes and no. As funny as it sounds, okay. Self-confidence is important because you have to trust your own judgment on your decisions, but you can't have any ego. So it's an interesting, you've got to have the confidence but no ego, and that's very hard to find. Because in the end, the director and the actor are going to get credit for whatever project was done. So you've got to be okay with that. And you've got to be okay sitting back, watching your product go out there without screaming, I need credit for attention.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure that because that's really the support end of, you know, of a production, you know, being, and it seems that, I mean, when you look at a film, there is just, granted you'll have, you know, one or two, maybe A-list actors, but there is just so many other people that are involved in the production that it just seems that you have to kind of be happy with whatever part you have that contributes to the whole.
You know, you're working 18, 20 hours a day when you're shooting. Mm-hmm. You gotta love your job. You really do. I mean, I love what I do. I think film, I think media, especially when you look at crossover media now with old media and new media, is a way of reaching people that we've never had. I can get into people's homes, into their cars, on their phones, on everywhere now, not just in the cinema and television. And it's a great way to reach out. So if you're putting out good content with a positive message, that's wonderful. If you're just putting out entertainment, which I just do entertainment, I don't do a lot of the positive message. I do fun and funny and entertainment because it gets people away from their life. You don't know what they've got going on. And it's a great way to give people a break. Because sometimes we all need it, you know, and it's trading one for the other. I give people the experience of getting away from their life, my chances of ever watching a film and not seeing it as a production. So it ruins movies for me. But everyone else, I feel like giving them a laugh.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, with any kind of job, when it's your work, when it's your job, you know, and particularly when it's, you know, putting together something like a production, that it's, you know, it's just a different perspective. You see everything that went into it, all of the challenges. You know, all the challenges. And
I'm sitting in the audience screaming, there's product placement, there's the boom mic. I can see the damn boom mic. Half the time it's bad, or I'm looking at their product placement going, that's done really well, I'm going to do it like that next time, because these companies help pay for these films because they're so bloody expensive.
I love catching product placement. I mean, I've you know, kind of looked at that in the past, and you know, now it's one of those things that I'm sensitive to when it comes to looking at a movie, and it does, you know, when you are looking, you know, at those various aspects or the boom, you know, what it does is it kind of removes you from the experience, you know, it kind of takes you away from the experience, and you now then you become separate from it. You're not as involved in it, and then it's kind of like, oh, I got to get back into it, you know. And
I still haven't forgiven Harry Potter for that. I haven't forgiven Harry Potter. I thought of Mike and Harry Potter. It was terrible.
Oh my goodness!
I love the world. But yeah, I saw the boom mic, and I still haven't forgiven Harry Potter.
Boy, that's a bad one for Harry Potter. Now, being one of the youngest executives in Hollywood, does that create any particular challenges, or are there some benefits to being one of the youngest?
I just found out I am the youngest ever, and I will be the youngest studio head come July ever. So I'm the youngest executive ever. And that's fantastic because I love to tell people I'm the youngest executive ever, but then you go into a boardroom and somebody gives you their coffee order. They don't realize you're there for the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I still get them their coffee, don't get me wrong, I don't mind. But I'm working with very brilliant, very experienced, mostly men. I think I'm usually the only woman in the boardroom, but it'll be myself and a bunch of guys between the ages of 60 and 90. So I a lot of times feel like the kid, but I bring the new media aspect in a way that they don't look at. And I enjoy it. I enjoy sometimes feeling like a kid or having these guys treat you like a kid is the price you pay to have their knowledge and to have them at your disposal. And I don't mind.
Yeah.
Because it gives me access to their knowledge and experience.
Yeah, that's good. Now, you mentioned a couple of times you mentioned old media and new media. For the listeners, can you help us recognize the difference between the two?
Old media would be television and movies. New media is internet, anything digital.
Okay. And when you do a production, in the plan, is it just strictly one or the other, or do you, you know, come obviously with, you know, TVs and movie, you're going to have some digital promotion and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you kind of work the two together in order to kind of maximize it?
Yeah, you do. I work predominantly in old media. As first run, which means it comes out first in old media, it'll go to the movies, then it'll go to Netflix, then it'll go to television, then it'll go, you know, it bounces back and forth. So the right distribution plan for any product or project now is whatever television network it's on, then it hits Hulu. For a movie, it'll be whatever cinema it's playing on, then it'll hit Netflix. Then when the television show is done on Hulu, it'll go to Netflix and then rerun on television. And the movie will go from Netflix to Hulu, then run on television. So it really just depends on the distribution plan you put together. But it's just trying to maximize eyeballs. My whole job is to make sure as many people see it as possible.
Yeah. So now where relationships play an important part in the creation of a project, is the same with the distribution plan between, you know, movie production companies and, you know, and the TV, it's like in Hulu. So, I mean, is there that same kind of
100%.
Network?
It's all relationships. There are like 10 major companies when it comes to product. I worked for Paramount for years and years and years, and they're a Viacom company. So you're really, really kind of pigeonholed in that direction, but not as much with new media. So it's setting the plans, but it's using the existing relationships, because most of the people running the distribution for new media are people from studios.
Okay. Now, when it comes time for first of all, I do want to let people know that we're going to be taking a break at the bottom of the hour. And if you have any questions for Summer, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And then for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions for Summer, feel free to type them in, and we'll get to them right after the break. So when it comes time for selecting a story or a project, is there anything in particular that you look for? I mean, you know, do you go out and look, or I'm sure you probably have people coming to you,
yeah,
right
I'm
left
pretty inundated.
With ideas.
I'm pretty inundated. I love to hear what people have to say. I picked up projects because I was talking to someone at the grocery store. Really, I'm big into comedy, so if it makes me laugh or the person makes me laugh, I'm pretty easily sold. If it looks like it can make some money, I'm in. I mean, really, it's all about following your gut. You can put the right formula together. You can do all of the right things. But in the end, you can screw up. I mean, I'm still mad at Paramount. We turned down Deadpool because we didn't think we could, not me. If it came across my desk, I'd have said yes. But they didn't think they could sell an R-rated superhero film. Now all the superhero films slated to come out are looking like they're going to be R-rated. We always go too far. We all jump on one track. And when I can find something different, that really kind of makes me jump for joy. I love to bring something different, and I love to bring people into the industry that weren't there. I love to work with new people and new talent, so we're not getting the same old stale story. I hate remakes. I absolutely hate them. I think there's enough new material out there that it's just not necessary.
Yeah, I'm with you there. You know, and you know, it's to me, you know, when I see a familiar storyline used over and over again, I mean, to me, it's like, ugh, you know, isn't there something different? You know, give me something different. You know, it's kind of like, I know how this ends. You know, I mean, it happens the same way over and over again, and that can be frustrating. And you know, to me, it dampens my interest. And even if it's something new that's out.
I completely agree with you, and I think there are certain genres, like the rom-com, the romantic comedies, you want the people to be together in the end. But the story itself, to get there, can be interesting. 50 First Dates is one of my favorites, because it was original. The person losing her memory and the way it was done was incredible. But they tried to recapture that magic and put Drew Barrymore and Adam Sandler together again, and the film flopped. It's like catching lightning in a bottle. If you can get the right formula and the right story, it's fantastic. When you do it wrong, you get Waterworld. It really depends on the story. But once you start doing remakes, I swear to God, if I see Miley Cyrus, you know, starring in Casablanca, I'm going to kill someone. So far, you can go with the remakes that are okay. You know, we've got too many shark movies. Everyone's trying to, you know, recapture Jaws. It was done. You're not going to beat Spielberg. Let it go.
Yeah. You know, that's I'm with you there. You know, they're certainly definitely like fresh and new. And so now, you said that you like working with comedies. Now, when you've worked with projects now both on the big screen and small screen. Is that correct?
I've done television and film, yes.
Okay, so what is the differences between the two? You know, as far as the efforts that you need to put forth, and do you have a preference as to one over the other?
Oh, I'm going to get myself in trouble saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I like television because you create longer lasting relationships. I like film because it's intense and then it's over. With television, you're working with people, God willing, the show does well for a longer period of time, but the differences are getting smaller and smaller. The more we have films like The Avengers, that it's just one after the other, it's just like doing a TV show. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference between film and television is getting smaller, unless you step into the indie film bracket. I've never really worked in indie film, but I genuinely admire anyone that can because they have to wear 50 different hats. So the differences between television and film, really, there aren't that many. You've got more cameras going on usually for a film than a television show. B-roll's done a bit differently. A one-off film has its differences. When you go into something like Harry Potter or into The Avengers, it's just like doing a TV show. The only major differences are when they change out directors. Each director brings in his new style and screws the whole thing up because he wants it to be different. And it's the same in TV. When you trade out directors, the new director brings in his own style and screws everything up. Because he wants it to be different. I told you, I was going to get myself in trouble.
I know. Watch out, directors.
There are so many talented directors, but I find it frustrating, especially in a series, when a director wants to come in and differentiate himself. The way I'd love to see him differentiate himself is by expanding the characters or choosing different camera angles. Once you get into the lens flares and you want this character to look different, I mean, there's one Harry Potter where both Harry and Ron grew out their hair for absolutely no reason. And things were just done differently, and it didn't fit into the series. The same with The Last Avenger. It can spoil it for the audience, and a great director is somebody whose hands you can't see in it. It's a world come to life. Once you can see the director's hand in the film, it means he's done poorly.
Yeah. So do you think that, you know, because you mentioned about ego, do you think that it, you know, the idea of the differentiation being so noticeable? Okay.
That's all ego. Okay. That's just these guys going, I'm going to be different. I'm going to stand out. This is going to be the best of whatever series it's in. This is going to be the best season of whatever. It's all ego. And it's part of the reason producers shouldn't have an ego. Executives shouldn't have an ego. Because you are working with overly sensitive directors that all act like, you know, two-year-old children. You're working with actors who are so self-centric that it's not even funny. And no, I don't mean self-centered. I mean self-centric. That's it. That's all that exists. It's interesting. You have to have a lot of confidence, but you have to be very, very flexible because you're dealing with a lot of different personalities. Some of the personalities are volatile, but most of the personalities are, for any of you that have children, I adopted two children. I've never had a two-year-old. The youngest I adopted was five, but I've never had a two-year-old. Uh-huh. But from what I hear two-year-olds act like, going mine, and grabbing, that's kind of how these guys act. So I can't tell you exactly. I've never had a two-year-old, but from what I hear, that's what they behave like. It's mine! I want to do this! I'm going to be different.
Yep.
Look at my drawing. I'm special.
Yep, exactly. I've been around the terrible twos, and it is, you know, there is that, you know, that the world revolves around them, you know, when they have that, you know, that I am here, you know, I am king or queen, you know, and, you know, you'll do as I say, kind of attitude.
That's exactly it. It's the little kids going, I'm the princess. That's kind of what it's like working with some, not all, most of the big actors are actually really easy to work with. That's how they got big. It wasn't that they were overly talented. It's that they were easy to work with. They showed up on time, so they got big. The problem is, it's not the ones that have made it that act like bastards. It's the ones that think they have and then try and cue they have by acting like a big shot. That's where you get the, I'm the princess, from.
Wow, absolutely. Well, we're halfway through the show, Summer, so I want to take just a quick 90-second break. And then when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about just, you know, the film industry and you know, it being decentralized, you know, with, you know, film production being in so many different locations throughout the country and the world, and talk about how that has impacted Hollywood, okay?
Okay,
great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short 90-second break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, Also on the site is a link to the great products we provide. Books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Summer Helene, the Duchess of Hollywood and host of Behind the Scenes on Voice America. So with that, we're back. Summer?
G'day, g'day.
G'day, g'day. All righty. So, as I mentioned before the break, you know, one of the things that we've noticed is that, you know, film production seems to be pockets, you know, throughout the U.S. where film production is kind of taken off. There have always been, you know, on location kinds of production, but it seems that the industry itself is maybe becoming a little bit decentralized away from Hollywood. So, can you talk a little bit about that? Is that really kind of what's going on? Is that my perception of that, or
you're pretty right. Los Angeles feels it's not going to lose the industry business because the major studios are there, but we're not filming outside the studios as much as we used to, and there's so much stock footage of LA that we have no need to. When you have states like Louisiana and Hawaii, states that are offering you mass incentives. We get so much money back just to film in those states, because once we get there, we're renting their equipment, we're doing all of this, we're hiring their people. So the state gives us an incentive to do that. What's the point of staying in Los Angeles? I'm sorry to my people in LA. I love LA and I love working and filming
right.
there, but they're not giving us incentives. And then when they did do the last incentive, the incentives are meant to bring film in. The studios jumped on all the incentives, so the people that would have come in and made the film didn't have access to it. So it was very poorly planned. It was very, very poorly planned.
Well, so now with the fact that, you know, you have those states, you know, offering incentives, when it comes time to planning a project, obviously probably certain ones require certain geographical, have certain geographic requirements, but I mean, when it comes time to determining where a project is going to be filmed, is that incentive package, you know, within the states, is that kind of one of the major
factors
that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The same reason we film outside the country. I mean, the Avengers isn't even shot in the country. It is so much cheaper to shoot elsewhere, and we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot doing that. I'd love to see Los Angeles put its incentives back, because the studio lots in Los Angeles are sitting there unused. If you go on Paramount lot, you see so many empty sound stages that aren't being used because we're not doing even our own productions. Paramount is not shooting its own productions in the country. It's really depressing.
Wow.
And it's because the state and the city kind of turned on the industry. They got used to us being there, so they stopped incentivizing. And the industry really brings a lot of money into Los Angeles and into California itself. And over the years, California's economy has seriously been affected by the films leaving and the companies leaving. So it's very poorly planned. I'd like to see a governor step in and put some more incentives to keep the film in Los Angeles and keep the film in California.
Yeah. Well, you know, now you mentioned, you know, the international aspect of it. I mean, is when it comes time to production, I mean, it seems that, you know, filming internationally would have so many challenges, you know, just with the fact of, you know, being in another country and trying to maintain, you know, to do everything that is necessary to have a production created. Now, is it the same kind of thing where you maybe have relationships with like sister companies there where it makes it easier maybe
a lot of the
to
time,
assemble
a lot
what's
of,
necessary?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It really depends. It really, really depends. In Australia, there are sister companies, but a lot of government, a lot of film is backed by the government, the same as the Ukraine, the same as a lot of places. So what will happen is we'll go through someone we know, and they'll set it all up. So we'll go through a company we know or a person we know. They set everything up, and then we're just flying in our actors, so the people on screen are the same, and the director and DP. But for the most part, everyone else is picked up overseas. So even bringing in an entire production, you're bringing in maybe 20 people, and what you're spending in airfare, you're saving across the board.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Now, you know, with the range of productions from, you know, mega budget films, and it seems like there are a lot of them, to the smaller independent films, it seems that, you know, obviously if they're you have a mega budget, then you obviously to get the return, you have to have, you know, a mega audience, you know, with that. Has it gotten a little crazy in a way with the budgets of some of the super films?
Well, we call them the tentpole films. They're the films that hold up the studio and put it in a good light. They're the big films for the year. For Paramount, it's the Avengers. But the studios are now having to cross. You'll see Paramount and Universal going on one film because they can't afford it. I think the age of the tentpole film is dying. I don't think, in my opinion, I don't see the money being viable. You can make something like Deadpool, but Deadpool had a much smaller budget than the Avengers and made a lot more money. So it's choosing your product more wisely will save you a lot of money.
Yeah.
But I think the age of the tentpole has died.
Okay, yeah, because, you know, it seemed to me that, you know, in a business that is so conscious of return on investment, you know, that, you know, with such a outrageously high, you know, budgets, that return, I mean, you know, when you have a flop, you have a huge loss for one of those production companies.
Even for the major studios, a flop could risk closure. Disney had John Carter come out, it was almost detrimental to Disney Studios, and not many people know that. They think Disney, so they think it's, you know, infallible. But the reality is you have to have so many hands, so many eyes on it. John Carter is one of our examples of the worst thing that can happen to you. I didn't mind the film. It wasn't a bad film. But it was poorly marketed, poorly sold, and you had no idea what it is. I didn't know what it was when I went and saw it. And I only watched it because it was used as an example of what not to do. I think when you look at a micro-budget film, something like The Blair Witch Project or My Big Fat Greek Wedding, the Blair Witch Project would be a micro-budget. My Big Fat Greek Wedding would be a small budget. A micro-budget film like The Blair Witch Project is a flash in a pan. One in a million of those will hit and make a lot of money and do well. On the flip side, like Saw, it did really, really well. I think we're on Saw number, 315 now. On the flip side, you have My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which was around $5 million and distributed by HBO. It did really well. And the second one just came out, and they could not recapture that magic. If they had done it closer to the original release, they could have. But she didn't want to do that. And there was no story then because the director and writer is a wonderful woman. But the studios are just very cautious. They try and fund what they know can sell. Not what they think can sell, but what they know can sell. And that leads you to problems like the movie The Incredible Hulk that failed. Or catastrophes like Waterworld, which was a $100 million flop. We all have great films and bad films. But when you're dealing in the tent poles and the major budget films, one mistake is crippling. So you have to make sure that you have the best eyes on this film, and you have to make sure there's audience interest. Because it's not just making your money back long term. That opening weekend is going to determine how well that film does. And if you see a film in the theaters that's still being advertised on television, that film is failing. Once that film finishes, there's no need to advertise it anymore.
Okay. I'll keep my eye open on that for that.
Well, if it says now playing, that means they're trying to recoup the money by continuing advertising because they've dumped all of this money and you're supposed to do, like, just a slam, a media slam. As much advertising as you can before it opens so everyone goes in.
Right.
And
then it's
going to
be supposedly
out.
Yeah. And while it's out, then the idea is it's supposed to be word of mouth and repeat viewership.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it should be perpetuating itself. So the reality
is
if you see a film that's being advertised when it's out, something has gone terribly wrong. And it's a little frightening, really. It's really frightening because it ends careers. If you're in charge and that's your film, you're out. Kevin Costner has never gotten his career back. And I love Kevin Costner. He does cameos, and I think he's great, but he has never gotten his career back to what it was. Hollywood can be very forgiving of mistakes. It can also hold on to them. In cases like Mel Gibson, we have not been forgiving. Once you get anti-Semitic and nasty, you're in a bit of trouble. In case that, you know, if you screw over your cast members, like Catherine Bigelow, who complained about her Grey's Anatomy while she was on it and said the writers were terrible and they shouldn't have gotten an Emmy, they're probably going to kill you in the show.
really?
On the flip side, if you do something dumb, like, you know, I fell off the stage at the African Oscars in front of the King of Nigeria. I did not even know there was a King of Nigeria. Then I fell off the stage. My dress went over my head. The world saw my Sphinx, and I ended up on TMZ. Everybody had a good laugh and moved on. You have Jennifer Lawrence fall over. You have people do dumb stuff. You have people fall out of dresses. You have all kinds of stuff. And people can be forgiving. Yeah. Then on the flip side, you have moments like Tara Reid at Puff Daddy's party. Her breast popped out of her dress. People saw that she had a scar from breast implants, and it ended her career.
Wow.
It can be very, very forgiving or very harsh. It really depends on how you respond to it.
And it seems like also a major part of that is the intent behind it, whether or not it's, you know, the person is just a mistake or an error or something they didn't, you know, really know versus something malicious.
Yes and no. It also depends on your publicist and who you are. If you have a decent publicist, you don't have a problem. Hugh Grant got caught with Divine Brown, who's a prostitute.
Right.
He had a fantastic publicist. She was a friend of mine. Her name was Cindy Honig. She wrote a great book. It's called PR Rockstar. It tells you all about how to get famous and get known. Actually, I just had the owner of Off-Road Rentals walk in here. I told you I was hiding at the ATV place. He just walked in here, so I'm waving to him. So that's the crashing you're hearing as he just walked in here. But if you have a good publicist, that changes things. A good publicist and you're contrite. Hugh Grant immediately went out and said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to let you down." Then you have the people who try and defend their actions. The one thing I've learned, don't have ego, don't defend your actions. If you screw up, admit it emphatically. Follow what Dale Carnegie says. Admit it emphatically and quickly.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. So, one of the things... Another role that you have, besides being the Duchess of Hollywood, is the host of the show Behind the Scenes. I believe it's on Voice America, correct? So tell us about it. Tell us about Behind the Scenes.
Behind the Scenes is a radio show I do. It plays on.
Did I lose you there?
40. Oh. I played on Sirius. But. The best way to get it is go to Voice America. It's on Friday night at 4 p.m. It's how to get in the industry, how to navigate the industry, and how to get famous. The truth is, fame and Hollywood, it's all a formula. And if you're not born with the looks or the intelligence, it makes no difference. Look at Jonah Hill.
He's just funny.
Uh-huh.
Funny makes all the difference. And that's what we talk about. We talk about how to get your business seen, how to get your film made, how to get yourself where you want to be. Because Hollywood is just a business. We're just a film business. And it runs the same way. So we talk about how to get your ROI, your return on investment, when you're doing a film, be it a big film or an indie film. We talk about how to deal with your product partners and how to correctly embed your placement. We talk about how people get into the industry. We have a lot of experts come on. We have a lot of actors come on, and we just talk about how they got in. We have a good laugh. I do have to say it's 18 and over because I have a very dirty mouth, and so do most of the people I work with. So we're very cut and dry, so I'm being very well behaved. Every time I've said on this show, it means a bad word has wanted to come out of my mouth. So that happens on my show. I have to say it's an 18 and over show for sure. Because we do talk about sex, we do talk about violence, because those are the things that sell movies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, goodness. Well, definitely worth listening to. So,
it is.
Now, one of the final areas that I want to cover with you is I recognized in your biography that you work with charities, and that charities,
yes,
charity work is important to you. So can you talk about maybe, you know, those that you've worked with, you know, how does charity
fit? Do you
want to
hear the good stories
fit?
Or the bad stories? Because I have charities that have been disasters and charities have been fantastic.
Well, you know, I'd like to have one of these because, you know, some people don't recognize that there could be a bad charity story.
For the most part, I work with the Wounded Soldier Program. I work with the California Foster Care Program. I work with the Humane Society and a lot of different charities. Most charities are fantastic, and you'll hear the same thing from anyone involved. Please give to them. They really need it. You have no idea how badly children can be treated, and they do need it. The foster care system is so broken that when you can give to a children's charity, please do. You know, I adopted two children. My daughter was one of the worst cases of child abuse in the state of Mississippi. My son was one of the worst cases of child abuse in California. Both of them were severely abused, severely neglected. And if more money and resources had been put towards the foster system and been put towards the child protective services in either of those states, that wouldn't have happened. There would have been enough boots on the ground that these kids didn't get hurt. And that didn't need to happen. So I always encourage that. And the same with the animal charity. It's insane the number of animals that are abused. You know, I have Michael Vicks has tried to be on my show and quite a few other things we've done, and I won't work with him. The NFL can be forgiving. I'm not. Not when it comes to hurting animals. Not when it comes to hurting kids. There are a lot of people, I don't think there's a way to make amends for that. If he spent his whole life trying to do a pit bull rescue every time he went near a dog, I'd probably kick him. These charities, they do. They exist for a reason. I've worked with great charities. I've only really had one bad experience with a charity, and that was with the Animal Samaritans in Palm, I think it's in Desert Hot Springs. And we offered them $100,000. They completely screwed up the deal, didn't take the money. We had trouble with the director, the board of directors. They're putting down animals consistently. The shelter's about to close, and they didn't want to take the money because part of the requirement for them taking the money meant they had to put the business together in a better way. And charities are still a business. They're run like a business. The board of directors pays, you know, the pays the head, whoever's running it. People, they get paid. And if you've got bad people in those positions, people are very reluctant to give you money because I don't want to give money to incompetent people and it's not going to go to the animals because I know these salaries have to be paid, and I think that's a good thing. Then on the flip side, you know, I work with like the Diamond in the Raw Foundation, which helps foster girls in Los Angeles get into the film industry and get through college. So I've had good and bad, but I would say never work with Animal Samaritans. Like, just don't. There are some really nice people there, but the business itself is bad, and so I think the animals are suffering because of that. And that happens with a poorly run charity. But when you have well-run charities like the Diamond in the Raw Foundation and the Humane Society, it really helps the animals and it helps the kids that are supposed to benefit. Rather than lining the pockets of those that shouldn't. I don't like lining the pockets of those that shouldn't.
No, I agree with you there. Yeah, you know, and also, you know, when you were talking about the foster care, I had a woman on my show, it was April of last year. Her name is Shenandoah Cephalo. Anyway, she wrote a book called Garbage Bag Suitcase, and it was, you know, the awareness of the foster care system and the need and just how, you know, for many foster children, a plastic bag sometimes is their suitcase going from home to home. And then it was, her book was just so riveting, you know, and that, I mean, it was, you know, from that point on, I've followed her work and it's, you know, it's just wonderful when you can get someone out there and, you know, and advocate, for, you know, for the children.
I absolutely agree. I think it's the foster care system is terrible. We have people adopting children and then there's something called rehoming. It originally started with animals. It's when you adopt an animal and then give it to somebody else. They started doing it with children. It's called rehoming children. People adopt children and don't realize what the challenge is going to be. It's one thing if you adopt an infant, but it's another when you adopt a child that has strong memories of where they came from. They feel the loss of their birth family. You are dealing with a level of violence that you didn't expect. You're dealing with a level of anger that you didn't expect. And it's a lot of counseling, a lot of patience. I had, you know, one of my children stabbed me the first week they were there. It was a butter knife.
Oh, no.
It was a butter knife. They didn't know the difference. But when you're looking at a history of abuse and neglect, you know, my daughter spent years left at the front porch with the dogs, just not being fed.
Wow. Boy, yeah, that's a shame. Well, you know, kudos to you for adopting, you know.
Oh, they,
you know,
they do way more for me than I do for them.
Yeah.
They do way more for me. I'd lose my mind without them.
That's good.
They're
lucky children. They're lucky children. Well, now, I'm following you on Facebook. You're on Facebook. Behind the Scenes is on Facebook. And is there and how else can people get in touch with you if they would like to?
My name's Summer Helene, H-E-L-E-N-E, Summer like the season. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can find Behind the Scenes on Facebook and Twitter. Just Google me. I'm kind of everywhere. If you want to get into the entertainment industry, catch me on Facebook, catch me on Twitter. I'm always happy to talk to you, and I'm always happy to help out because I'm looking for fresh faces and new ideas.
Great. Well, I liked your page on Facebook, and I'll be sure to join you on Instagram and Twitter once we hang up. So I really want to thank you for your time today, Summer. I really enjoyed chatting. I learned a lot.
Well, I had a great time talking to you. I'm going to go ride some ATVs now, and I'm definitely going to have to listen into your show. It's interesting. You ask a lot of questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Well, again, we'll keep in touch, and I look forward to following your journey. So, again, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Enjoy your ATV ride.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Summer Helene, the Duchess of Hollywood and also host of the Behind the Scenes Radio on Voice America. And again, like she said, you can follow her on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So definitely follow her and contact her if you have any questions or you're one of those fresh faces that she's looking for. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.